The black and white film that was playing on the television made flickering images dance on the walls of the dark LA apartment. It was the only light in the room, and as the scene shifted on the screen, the apartment grew dark and then brightened again, illuminating the man who was slumped on the couch across from the television set. A cigarette burned, forgotten in an ashtray on the coffee table in front of him, and he held a sweating bottle of beer in his hand. He'd forgotten about that, too. He was gripped by the story that unfolded in the film. Next to him was a battered notebook in which the man had written some notes about the chilling story, which, as it turned out, wasn't just a movie. It was based on real life. And when the man found that out, he became even more obsessed by the terrible events that occurred 2 decades before. He'd keep coming back to the one line that he'd written in the notebook on the night he watched that film on television. "There's a killer on the road," he'd written. It was meant to be the first line of one of his many poems, but it became a song instead. That poet was Jim Morrison, and the words he'd written became the first line of one of the classic tunes for his band, The Doors, a song called Riders on the Storm. It's a song that's a strange mixture of psychedelic rock, jazz, and art rock. It's also an eerie song, with added sound effects of rain and thunder and an unsettling doubling of Jim Morrison's lead vocal with a spoken whisper track underneath. But that wasn't all that was unsettling about it. Riders on the Storm turned out to be the last song Morrison ever recorded. When the album was finished, he left LA for Paris and either died on July 3rd, 1971, or he went permanently off the grid, whichever you'd like to believe. But it's the lyrics behind the song that's the most unsettling of all. It was inspired by one of the most sinister spree killers in history. His reign of terror began in the last days of 1950, and over the next 2 weeks, he went on a senseless rampage. He kidnapped nearly a dozen people, including a deputy sheriff, and murdered 6 of them in cold blood, including 3 children. During those 14 days, the killer, a born loser named Billy Cook, terrorized the highways of the American Southwest and earned a permanent place in the history of music and as the inspiration for 2 terrifying films. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of America. And welcome to the latest episode of Season 9, a season we've called Based on a True Story. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. And this season, we're bringing you some of the scariest and most uncomfortable films about ghosts, demons, murder, and mayhem that have ever been shown on the silver screen. But you can't watch any of them and say, it's only a movie. Every episode of this season offers the true story behind these horrifying films. Stories that are usually much scarier than anything a movie studio can create. This is episode 23 of season 9, The Hitcher. Billy Cook was born in 1929 near the southwestern Missouri town of Joplin. His early years were tough, growing up during the Depression, and he had to make do with money, food, and clothing divided up between 7 brothers and sisters. His father, Will, was a laid-off coal miner with no education, and after losing their house following the death of Cook's mother, he moved himself and his kids into an abandoned mine shaft. Until one day when Dad hopped a freight train and left the kids behind. The authorities found the children huddled in the old mine, dressed in rags, scrounging for food, and living like animals. They became wards of the state, but soon all were either adopted or sent to foster homes. Except for Billy. There was, everyone agreed, something not quite right about Billy. He rarely spoke. He menaced younger children at the state home and had a sinister-looking deformity of the right eye that never allowed the lid to close all the way. It earned him the unflattering nickname of Cockeyed. He was eventually taken in by a woman who did it purely for the government payout, and she and Cook never got along. But she didn't have to tolerate him for very long. As he got older, Billy began staying out all night, shoplifting, vandalizing homes and businesses, and getting into other kinds of trouble. He ended up spending most of his formative years at a reform school after he told a judge he'd prefer that to foster care. Billy believed he'd simply been born bad, and he embraced it. While locked up, he tattooed the words "hard luck" across the knuckles of both hands. He was released after serving his time, but almost immediately, he robbed a cab driver of $11 and stole a car. Quickly arrested again, criminal genius he was not, he was sent back to the reformatory where he was supposed to stay for the next 5 years. But he turned out to be so dangerous to the other juvenile offenders that they sent him to the Missouri State Penitentiary, where he finished his sentence. Even as a young boy in this feared institution, Billy stood out among the other inmates, once beating a man so severely with a baseball bat, the man almost died. The other man had made the mistake of laughing at Billy's drooping eyelid. Billy was finally released in 1950 and started hitching rides across the Southwest, ending up in Blythe, California. He found a job as a dishwasher, the only legitimate job he ever had, but became bored and started wandering again. His next destination was Texas, and somewhere along the way, he picked up a .32 caliber handgun, which he kept tucked away in his pocket, just in case. By now, Billy had little use for anyone and frankly hated everyone. The violence and despair of his youth turned into rage, and eventually it boiled over. On December 30th, he kidnapped a motorist near Lubbock, Texas, locked the man in the trunk of his car, and drove off with him. Fortunately, the driver managed to use a jack handle to open the trunk from the inside. He held it down until Cook turned off the highway and onto a secondary road. Convinced that Billy planned to kill him, the driver jumped out when the car slowed down and he escaped. Billy Cook, though, kept driving. He traveled the lonely stretch of Route 66 between Claremore and Tulsa, Oklahoma, before the stolen car ran out of gas. He left the vehicle on the side of the road and started walking. It wasn't long before he saw a 1940 Chevrolet coming in his direction. Cook waved frantically as if he'd experienced car problems and grinned as the car slowed down and then stopped. The driver of the car was Carl Mosser, and he and his wife Thelma and their three small children were on vacation, traveling from Decatur, Illinois to New Mexico. They were just nice people, trying to help a young man who seemed down on his luck. Billy repaid their kindness by pulling a pistol from his pocket and forcing Carl to drive and keep driving. They drove west across Oklahoma and crossed into Texas. Carl, desperately worried about his family, could only hope that his brother Chris, who lived in Albuquerque and was expecting them, would become concerned and alert the authorities when they didn't arrive when planned. By the time they'd reached Wichita Falls, Texas, Carl was frantically trying to think of some way to get rid of the maniac sitting next to him in the passenger seat. He thought he saw his chance when the car started to run low on gas. He convinced Cook to stop at a service station for gas and food, and when he stopped at the pump, he directed the attendant to fill the tank. When Carl and Billy went into the station to get sandwiches, Carl attacked the younger man until the frightened attendant pulled a pistol and ordered both of them to get out of his station. Outside, Carl continued to fight, but Billy got the better of him and forced him into the car. Cook, now seething with rage, forced Carl to keep driving. They drove pointlessly around New Mexico, Texas, and Arkansas, and then he directed Carl to his old stomping grounds of Joplin, Missouri. By this time, after 72 hours of terror and trauma, Thelma had reached her limit. She became hysterical and started to cry. This started the children wailing, and unable to shut them up, Billy gagged all of them but Carl. They drove around Joplin for hours, and now, tired of the family, Billy turned his gun on the Mossers and killed them all. He dumped their bodies in a place he knew well, the old abandoned mine shaft that he and his siblings had once called home. Billy drove off in their car, and he vanished for a time, but unfortunately didn't stay gone for long. A few days after Billy killed the Mossers, their Chevy was found abandoned along Route 66 near Tulsa. The interior was covered in blood, and bullet holes had been punched into the seats. Billy also left behind a clue, a receipt for the .32 caliber pistol that he'd bought when he left his dishwasher job in California. His name was printed on the receipt. And with an identity linked to the blood-soaked car, the authorities began a massive manhunt for the missing family and for Billy Cook. The Mossers were found first, their bodies left behind in that mine shaft. This amped up the publicity about the missing Billy Cook, and he was making headlines in newspapers from coast to coast. Law enforcement agencies throughout the West were on the lookout for him. Wanted posters appeared and radio commentators warned motorists against picking up hitchhikers. A warning that, of course, came too late for the Mosser family. Soon, Billy surfaced again, back in California. When he ran afoul of a deputy sheriff, Billy kidnapped him at gunpoint and forced the officer to drive him around while he bragged about executing the Mosser family. After about an hour, Billy grew bored and forced the deputy to pull over, get out of the car, and lay down in a ditch. Billy cuffed the man's hands behind his back and then calmly informed him he was going to put a bullet in the man's head. The deputy braced himself for the shot, but it never came. Instead, he heard Cook's footsteps fading away as his boots crunched in the gravel along the side of the road. The deputy would never know why he was spared. Meanwhile, Billy's latest stolen car had run out of gas, and he managed to get a new ride by flagging down a driver named Robert Dewey. Billy opened the door and got into the passenger seat, but they'd only traveled a short distance before Billy shot the man in the side without warning. Although he was wounded, Dewey fought back. As the pair struggled, the car left the road and careened out into the desert. Finally, Billy managed to get his gun free and ended the fight with a bullet to the other man's head. He pulled the body from the car and dumped him into a ditch. By this time, Billy knew he was wanted all over the Southwest, so he decided to cross the border into Mexico. He made one last stop, kidnapped two men at a diner, and brought them along to Santa Rosalia, a few miles over the border, where he let them go. Amazingly, Billy was recognized by the local police chief, Francisco Morales. He simply walked up to Billy, snatched the pistol out of his belt, and placed him under arrest. Then, before federal authorities in Mexico knew what was happening, Morales rushed Billy to the border and turned him over to FBI agents who were waiting there. Billy's arrest set off a mad scramble among state officials. Despite the slaying of the Mosser family in Missouri, he was turned over to the California authorities and was tried for the murder of Robert Dewey, the motorist he'd killed just before crossing the border. Billy expressed as little regret about Dewey's death as he did about the others, and a jury convicted him and sentenced him to death. Billy Cook died in the gas chamber at San Quentin on December 12, 1952. His last words were as charming as he was. When asked for them, he replied, "I hate everybody's guts and everybody hates mine." Billy Cook's funeral took place in the dark of night at Peace Church Cemetery, a wooded burial ground outside of his hometown of Joplin. A brief service was held with flashlights and lanterns, and about 15 people were in attendance. Billy was buried in an unmarked grave, hoping to avoid local scrutiny. According to a reporter who was there that night, just as the service ended, he wrote, quote, "The cry of a small child could be heard in the chill of the night air." This was the first hint that there might be something spooky going on with Billy Cook and Peace Church Cemetery, but it wouldn't be the last. It's not uncommon today to go to the cemetery and find things like flowers, notes, and candles left in various spots that people believe might be the location of Cook's unmarked grave. It's been rumored that local teenagers have congregated in the graveyard many times to try and contact Billy's spirit. In 1987, three 17-year-old boys were discovered to have killed several animals and then murdered a 19-year-old acquaintance by beating him to death with a baseball bat. At their trial, the defense claimed they'd been engaging in satanic rituals. I mean, it was the height of the satanic panic, after all, and had been influenced to commit the murder by the spirit of Billy Cook. The jury wasn't buying it, and they were convicted of murder. But despite what the jury believed, many people are convinced that Billy doesn't rest quietly in the old cemetery. Over the years, stories have circulated about a shadowy figure that's been seen lurking on the grounds and wandering among the trees. Whoever this figure is, it seems lost and confused, and some have remarked it appears to be angry about something. If this lingering spirit is that of Billy Cook, then his anger becomes clear. In real life, Billy hated everyone and everything, and likely his hatred about being born hasn't gone away, even after death. But Billy Cook didn't just inspire local ghost stories. His dark influence was first felt in that movie that Jim Morrison watched one night, the 1953 thriller, The Hitchhiker, which was co-written and directed by Hollywood legend Ida Lupino. The film tells the story of two buddies, Roy Collins and Gilbert Brown, played by Edmund O'Brien and Frank Lovejoy, who set out on a weekend fishing trip. But things don't turn out as planned after they make the mistake of picking up a hitchhiker named Emmett Myers. Now, he's played by William Tallman, who became most famous playing District Attorney Hamilton Berger in the Raymond Burr Perry Mason TV series. He turns out to be a murderous psychopath who kidnaps the men and forces them to drive to Mexico. Along the way, their attempts to flee are hampered by Myers' creepy ability to literally sleep with one eye open. When writing the film, Ida Lupino interviewed the two men who were Billy Cook's last captives, and she even visited Billy in San Quentin shortly before his execution. She said later, quote, "I was afraid of him. I could not wait to get the hell out of San Quentin." Her film was released in March 1953, just a few months after Cook's execution, but that release didn't come without challenges. Thanks to the motion picture production code of the time, which controlled the depiction of sex and crime in the movies, Lupino had to decrease the number of Billy Cook's on-screen killings. The code also prevented her from using Billy's real name in the film, but she did exercise some creative liberties with the capture of the film's villain, spicing up the real-life undramatic arrest with two fistfights and a shootout. When the film was released, it was marketed with what you gotta admit is a pretty chilling line. It went, "When was the last time you invited death into your car?" And the unsettling feeling of inviting death into your car was something that Jim Morrison captured in Riders on the Storm. Some of those lyrics were lifted directly from Cook's bloody exploits. But no matter how grim the song might be, it put the Doors back on top of the charts. The song was one of the hits that came from the Doors' album, L.A. Woman. When it was produced, it had only been 5 years since the Doors' first album was recorded, and those 5 years had been a whirlwind. The band was physically worn out and mentally exhausted by the time they got together to work on L.A. Woman. It should be no surprise that things went badly. Tensions built between the Doors and their producer, Paul Rothchild, who had no interest in working with a band that clearly didn't have their songs together and were too unreliable to cut tracks. The rehearsals went on for about a month. The band straggled into the studio. Jim didn't show up half the time, and everyone seemed angry with everyone else. Rothchild later recalled they only had 4 or 5 songs that were defined enough to play as songs at that point. Now, they were great songs, but he couldn't get the band to play them decently. They rehearsed and rehearsed, but nothing came together. Finally, after calling Riders on the Storm, quote, "bad cocktail music," he walked out. And that seemed to do the trick. With Rothchild gone, the album came together. After it was finished, Jim left for Paris. It was unclear if he planned to return, make more music with the Doors, or drop out to write poetry full time. At that point, though, no one was too worried about it. The album was released in April 1971 and became an immediate hit. The first single was Lover Madly, but FM radio jumped on the title cut along with Riders on the Storm. The Doors were at the top of their game again, but Jim never came home to enjoy it. Whether he died or disappeared on his own, I mean, there's evidence to suggest that either might have happened, in my opinion. Anyway, he hasn't been seen since, but his musical legacy lives on, as does a song written about a killer whose hatred and rage could only be quenched by murder. But that wasn't the last place where the killer left his mark. There was also another film besides The Hitchhiker that used both Riders on the Storm and the crimes of Billy Cook as its bloody inspiration. The 1986 film The Hitcher drops us into the road trip of Jim Halsey, played by C. Thomas Howell, who's driving from Chicago to San Diego to deliver a car to a client. It's nighttime, the weather is bad, and the drive is monotonous. Even coffee and cigarettes can't keep him awake. So he stops to offer a ride to a hitchhiker. Like the Mosser family, he just wants to help someone, and he also hopes the company will keep him from falling asleep at the wheel. Unfortunately, he chooses the wrong person because the hitchhiker, John Ryder, played to his most menacing best by Rutger Hauer, is pure evil. A sadistic killer who drags the unfortunate young man into a horrific game of cat and mouse. Unlike Billy Cook, though, John Ryder is a mystery. Very little is ever known about him, which makes him even more frightening. His entire existence seems to revolve around this specific stretch of Route 66 where Jim picks him up. He has no criminal record, no insurance, no identification, nothing. He speaks only a few sentences. When asked where he's from, he replies, "Disneyland." He avoids answering most any other questions. So what does he want? Well, if his words are to be believed, he wants to be stopped, a desire that's often attributed to serial killers, leaving little doubt that he'd killed before. He begs Jim to stop him, to embrace his dark side and kill him, essentially becoming a murderer himself. Jim initially refuses to confront Ryder, only to realize along the way that being a decent, good, innocent person doesn't protect one from anything. Jim eventually gives in to the temptation for righteous reasons, but he still takes matters into his own hands. In what had been the original version of the film, this is even more evident. Jim kills Ryder while he's lying helpless on the ground. In the final version that was released in theaters, though, this scene is softened by Ryder getting to his feet, still a threat, giving Jim a justified reason to shoot him. The film's writer, Eric Red, was inspired by several things when he wrote the screenplay for The Hitcher. When he was 20 years old and living in New York, he'd made a short film that he hoped would be his ticket to a feature-length project. When no offers came in, he moved from New York to Austin, Texas, paying for the move by transporting a car for an auto company. He listened to a lot of music during the drive, including music by The Doors. One song in particular, Riders on the Storm, struck a nerve. He found that the elements of the song, a killer on the road in a storm, plus the cinematic feel of the music, would make a terrific opening for a film. And then when he discovered the inspiration for the song, Billy Cook, the story began to come together. During his seven-month stay in Austin, he drove a cab and wrote The Hitcher. In 1983, he sent a letter to several Hollywood producers asking if he could send them a copy of his screenplay. His letter concluded, quote, "It grabs you by the guts and does not let up, but it does not let go. When you read it, you will not sleep for a week. When the movie is made, the country will not sleep for a week." A script development executive at HBO Pictures named David Bombeck received a copy of Eric's letter and was intrigued by the description of the film. Red sent him his script, and just 3 years later, the film was in theaters. And I'll hazard a guess that many of those who saw it didn't, as Eric promised, sleep well for at least a week. The film later spawned a sequel that's mostly forgotten since it couldn't live up to the original film, and it was remade in 2007 and forgotten for mostly the same reason. Even with Sean Bean taking over the John Ryder character, it just couldn't compare to what Rutger Hauer had done with the role in 1986. Over the years, the character of John Ryder has become a symbol for the danger that lurks on the American highway, a nameless, cruel threat that hides in roadside diners, isolated motels, and truck stops. Always on the move and always unpredictable, the threat can cross state lines, elude the police, and vanish suddenly, only to return when least expected. By the time the original film came out in 1986, the public was finally starting to accept the brutal truth that the carefree days of traveling the country were fading. There were, as Jim Morrison wrote, killers on the road. And no one was safe from them because, like John Ryder, they were elusive, cunning, and unimaginably evil. So in this way, The Hitcher served as a warning. A killer like John Ryder, or even maybe Billy Cook, could be waiting anywhere, and if he wanted to, could easily disguise himself behind the facade of a friendly hitchhiker, smiling as he opens the car door and climbs into the passenger seat right next to you. Thanks again for listening to American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsors.
All right, let me set the scene for you here. It's midnight. You're lying in bed, scrolling through some probably creepy website that you found, because that's what our fans do. And you hit the add to cart button on the item you've been looking for. After 15 minutes, you decide you've done enough damage to your wallet and decide to check out. You remember that your wallet or your card is in the living room, and you don't want to get out of bed to go get it. Just as you're getting ready to abandon your cart, that's when you see it. That purple shop button. That shop button that has all of your payment and shipping information saved, saving you time while you stay warm in your bed. That's Shopify, and there's a reason so many businesses sell with it. Because Shopify makes anything easier, from checkout to creating your own storefront. Shopify is the commerce platform behind 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., from household names like Mattel and Gymshark, to brands just getting started, and the American Hauntings clothing store. Shopify gives you that leg up from day one with hundreds of beautiful, ready-to-go templates to express your brand style, and there's no need to worry about knowing how to write even a single line of code. Shopify has you covered. Tackle all those important tasks in one place, from inventory to payments to analytics and more. Spread your brand's word with built-in marketing and email tools to find and keep new customers. And did I mention that iconic purple Shop Pay button that's used by millions of businesses around the world? It's why Shopify has the best converting checkout on the planet. Your customers already love it. If you want to see less carts being abandoned, it's time for you to head over to Shopify. Sign up for your $1 per month trial and start selling today at shopify.com/hauntings. Go to shopify.com/hauntings. One more time, shopify.com/hauntings.
Heading west on the long, lonely highway, only his dreams for company, until...
My mother told me never to do this.
Before many miles, he'll wish he'd taken his mom's advice. When Jim Halsey let the hitcher into his car, he opened the doors of hell.
What do you want?
I want you to stop me.
Once you've met the hitcher, you'll never pick up another.
My wallet's in my pocket.
Shut up! We know how to do it.
Jesus!
Why are you doing this to me?
You're a smart kid. I'll figure it out.
I didn't do it. I didn't do any of it. I'm not a killer. Hold on! This morning, this guy tried to kill me. He's been following me ever since.
I'm ready when you are.
Sure. Okay. All right. Let's get this thing going. Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we're back with the postmortem, the part of the show after the show where we sharpen our knives and dissect the episode. My name is Troy Taylor, and I'm the guy who narrates and writes the show. And across from me is the guy who's planning to make a cross-country road trip during the holiday season this year. What could go wrong? It's my friend, producer, sidekick, and co-host, Cody Beck.
Troy, when I just tried to move 15 minutes away, It was already so bad. I can't imagine doing a road trip.
Making a cross-country road trip. Yes.
Especially
so we should probably say that just in case that you are still in the process of unpacking from your weekend move. And yes. So if anything sounds off, you guys will just have to bear with us because I bought a bunch of new equipment. Cody is, you know, using what he can to make it work.
It's probably like your audio sounds way better and my audio probably sounds way worse. But if we kind of average that out, then it's back to where we were.
Well, it'll be better than say season one or two. So look at it that way, or half of two anyway.
Yes. So. And Troy, can I just say with that little segue thing, I think you'll be fine with this, but also I don't think you'd be surprised by this. But I just want to say, anyone moving in the St. Louis area, especially Madison County, Mr. P's Moving Company.
Absolutely. Those guys are the best, man. They are the best.
You have way more books.
I think they come over to St. Louis too.
Okay. You have way more books than I do, but still, they had to take mine down like three flights of stairs, old stairs. And these guys cannot sing their praises high enough. And I text Troy about this so much, and that's why I just wanted to like give him a shout out. I'll give him a good look. You can look up my review. It'll be on the U-Haul website, and just amazing.
Yeah.
But I wanted to get that out.
Yeah, those guys have moved me several times. Yeah, they've moved me several times, and I have a lot of books.
I feel so bad for
them. Complaint. I mean, not a word. I remember that. Remember the story I've told you about those guys that moved me that one time and told me that when I move again, call somebody else because they didn't like carrying the books. But not these guys, man. They'll carry anything. They don't care. So
and they do, and they did, and it's amazing. I just wanted to get that out of the way so I didn't forget it. But no, Troy, we got other stuff going on.
I
had to get that.
Yeah,
in.
We. No, I'm glad you did. So, and we have. Two new podcasts now, in addition to this one, and then of course our Patreon one. So essentially, right now we have four podcasts for everyone to listen to. We have three of them on our regular feed, which is three of them on our regular feed, which is American Dread, which started last month, I believe, and then the new American Nightmares podcast, which started last week. Was our first episode. So that will continue to be rolling out. Both of those will, along with this podcast, of course. We've got a couple of episodes left in this season for this podcast, and then we'll take a little break. But as far as I know, neither Adam nor I will be taking any breaks from American Nightmares or American Dread. So American Hauntings will kick back off again in the new year with our new season. So which we're working on right now.
Yeah. And thank you all for rolling with, I know it's weird when different episodes pop up in your feed and stuff, but we're just trying to bring you all more content. So like, thanks for listening. Thanks for downloading and let us know what you think of everything. Yeah. And we're just trying to bring you more spooky stories more often.
Yep. Sounds good. So we do have, I do want to announce, we do have a couple. Now it's down to just a couple of events left at the current American Oddities Museum in November and December. Well, mostly just December now. But we do have all of our new events for the winter and spring that have already been posted at the new American Oddities Museum location, where we normally do our dinners and where our tours will begin leaving from after the first of the year. So you can check that out. But we do have one big event coming up that is open to everybody, doesn't cost you a thing to come to, and that's Small Business Saturday on November 29th. That will be at the current American Oddities Museum at the Mineral Springs Hotel. I have your book signing. I'll be doing a book signing from 12 to 5 that day. I'll also be releasing my new book, which is called Say Goodbye to Hollywood. And it is the rise and fall of good old Fatty Arbuckle, a book I've been wanting to write for a very long time. And it's one of those books that even if no one reads it, I really enjoyed writing it. So there it is. But it will be coming out that day. So if you are one of those people who would like to read it, you can come by and get a signed copy. We'll also have a sale on everything, kind of a store-wide sale in the bookstore that day. And buy any books, free museum admission for the 29th only. So
look at that.
We've never done that before, but we thought it might be fun. So, but then of course, we, as we've probably, I've already mentioned on here and we've posted online, the big move for the museum will be December 20th. I'm going to start packing on the 15th. So, hey, if you want to come help me pack, you can let me know. But otherwise, on the 20th, if you are willing to volunteer to help, we'll be giving out free passes to the museum that'll be good for an entire year. So you can drop us a text on the hotline if you're able and willing, or you can just go see the event that I created on my Facebook page. That's got all the information on it. So anyway, you can find that Facebook page under just looking up author Troy Taylor, or look up Troy Taylor's American Oddities Museum, because I was reminded, believe it or not, today of the hack that occurred a year ago. Oh, God. And there was a memory I did not want to revisit, but there it was. Good old Facebook loves to remind you of that stuff. But anyway, you can go to my current Facebook page, or you can just find everything we offer, from dinners to tours to Dead of Winter to the Haunted America Conference, at AmericanHauntings.net.
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, there's so many things I can say about the hack, but I won't. But hey, I wanted to give a quick shout out to our new patrons. So thank you so much for supporting the show, to Kathleen, Merrill, Ian, Leslie, Heather, Tracy, Jane, Michaela, Casey Mora, and Jeanette. So thank you very much for supporting the show. And, you know, over the years, Troy, I've had issues with a lot of the clothing stuff, whether it was, I hate to use the cliches and stuff, but supply chain logistics or tariffs, like that. And I know people have had some issues sometimes getting shirts and this and that and the other. But hey, if you're supporting the show, I'm promising you, you will be made whole. You'll get anything and everything. I'll probably send you all free coffee mugs and stickers. I appreciate everybody supporting the show so much. And I'm going to make sure that anybody, if you've ever been missing a shirt or didn't get something you wanted, or something went weird, went sideways, you're getting exactly what you want. And I'm going to figure it all out.
Just make sure Cody knows. He'll get it all figured out for you.
Yeah, so. I will get it all figured out. Thank you so much.
That Patreon program has been really great for us. And it is given me the impetus to create another podcast.
More podcasts,
So that's really our fourth one, but that one you can only get as a Patreon supporter. And we've got 5 seasons on there that you can binge right now. And we've got a new season that is just kind of getting rolling. We're a few episodes into the Star Rock Murders, and that has been, that's been a good one. People have been excited about it. And I still get a lot of people who, you know, talk to me about, oh, hey, I listened to your Albert Fish episode, or, you know, and they're like, oh, God, it's so awful. And I said, I know. But we got a lot of feedback when we, you know, on the Ed Gein season that we did, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre crossover season, which was a lot of fun to do. So, people have enjoyed it. We think you probably would too. So if you've been thinking about signing up for it, hey, now's the time. Yeah. We offer this show every other week, so it fits into the regular run of this show. And then of course we've got all kinds of other stuff popping up in our feed now, but it at least gives you another show that you can look forward to, alternate weeks. So just check it out. You can go to patreon.com/AmericanHauntings.
Yes. And if you've been watching the monster series on Netflix and stuff, and you're curious about, okay, what's the actual story? Like what really happened here? Check out Troy's Patreon series, because that'll tell you, separate the fact and the fiction. And it's honestly better, in my opinion. So Troy, great job. I think you beat out Netflix.
And, I also did a completely separate bonus episode that's just the Psycho story. Because it's not the same as Texas Chainsaw, obviously. They're very different movies. So I did a separate episode about the book and the film. And then, you know, Texas Chainsaw runs through most of the entire season, just kind of a going back and forth on the making of the film and then the real story of Ed Gein. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun. I have to admit that one has probably been my favorite just because of the variety. The Albert Fish one was definitely not my favorite, but it was an interesting story to tell. So
it's interesting, it's the right word.
Definitely the weirdest and the weirdest and most twisted for sure. So
yeah. Well, hey, I'll move on. We have a review from somebody on iTunes. So thank you very much for supporting the show and just leaving us a review on Apple Podcasts. This one comes to us from Kathleen123. There's like six or seven E's in there. But the title is The Best Out There. And the review is, I only started listening a couple months ago, and this has quickly become my favorite podcast network and host across all genres. No, I'm not AI. I just like them dashes. Okay. Or I just like M dashes. Okay. Which is a whole joke if you guys know about AI and M dashes. I just signed up through Patreon, not only for the additional content, though that is stellar, but because I'm genuinely happy to support these creators and their work. I'm only a hop, skip, and a jump away from upgrading my membership and buying merch. I don't technically need. The research and writing are excellent, and the delivery is one of a kind. I love how Troy's personality shines through in an often hilarious but never obtrusive way, and I really appreciate the variety in both topics and format. Thank you very much for supporting the show. Very, very excited for the future installments and expansions. That's what it says. Yeah, so thank you very much, Kathleen123.
Yeah, and since we read your review on the show, be sure to drop us your address on the hotline. We do that when we read your reviews. If you send us your address, we'll drop you something cool in the mail. And you can leave that address at 217-791-7859. I've got one that needs to go out this week from when we read last time. But yeah, be sure to do that, and we'll drop you something in the mail. So.
Beautiful. Are you ready to dive into this?
Yeah, let's talk about this episode. It's an episode. So,
Riders on the Storm. I knew that song. I could never listen to it the same. I
can't. Yeah, you probably can't now. Yeah.
thanks to you. This was a Joplin, Missouri. I mean, I know where that is. You know that,
right.
that's a closer. It a little bit. Well, starts a little closer to home, I guess, and then kind of bounces around. All over the place. This is the thing, Troy. I was wondering, is this one of those like, I guess, kind of perfect storms where this man probably would have done bad things, but because of what happened to him during his childhood, just made it escalate and just become even way worse, you think?
Well, I think there's always that argument of, you know, are monsters, you know, created? Are they born that way? Or are they made and created? I don't know. I think this guy probably had a couple of strikes against him to start out. But I'd say that definitely the, you know, conditions under which he was living as a small child probably didn't help. But even when he became a ward of the state and went to the foster home, he already had started to show what a, delinquent he was. I mean, he couldn't get along. And again, he's with a woman who didn't want him anyway. And she only took him because, you know, she could make the money from taking him. And then he goes to school and he gets nicknames because his right eye's messed up. And, you know, I think he just, you know, I just he probably was born bad. I mean, he always thought so. And maybe he was right. I don't know. I don't think there's any redeeming qualities about this guy whatsoever. None. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. I can't think of any. So
fair enough. It started to remind me of the Antlers movie that we waited for so long, as far as like being left in a mine and stuff.
Oh yeah, no kidding, right? I thought that too. And they lived in an abandoned mine shaft. I mean, that was their home. I mean, I get it. It was the Depression. You do what you got to do. But then the guy just skips town on a freight train and leaves his kids behind to starve, I guess. You know, but somebody found them. He also reminds me a lot, and we talked about him earlier this season when we did the Badlands episode. He's a very Charlie Starkweather-ish type guy.
Oh, sure. I mean,
so we got a couple of different people that came around around that same time who were both, you know, on the highway killing people for absolutely no reason.
Yep. Just because they could.
Yeah. At least with Starkweather, he had this, you know, he's obsessed with this girl that he drags along with him. This guy's just nuts. I mean, he's just
all over the place.
Yeah. You know, he's definitely, definitely a twisted individual here.
Well, it's the difference between the, I guess, typical, like, I guess, serial killer or whatever, but also like the spree killer thing. And I know some serial killers go on sprees and things like that, but like, it's when you finally snap versus just wanting to kind of plan stuff out. And even the spree killer has, you know, other bad things you probably don't know about in the past.
Well, this guy seemed to have no rhyme or reason to anything.
Yeah,
he
did, and that's the scariest.
I know, that's even scarier because, you know, he ended up in California and he picked up a gun just because he probably figured he was going to need it at some point.
Exactly.
You know, but what I really found interesting is that he kept the receipt.
The dumbest. Who does thing. That? It's the dumbest.
I just don't even understand why. I can't wrap my head around that. Everything else is so chaotic, and he keeps the receipt from his gun.
It reminded me of a problematic film, but Malibu's Most Wanted, when Jamie Kennedy is supposed to go in and rob a gas station, and he to prove he's like. Kind of like, you know, a gangster and stuff, but he ends up having a little bit of money in his like safety pocket, and he does that, and so he gets whatever liquor he's supposed to get, doesn't actually rob them, comes back out, and then they find the receipt, and he's like, I stole that too. It I was just like, yeah, it's the dumbest receipt. Thing to yeah. have the receipt yeah. for the gun. I know. Like it's, I know it. It's, I mean, I think that either shows, well, either level of stupidity or just really not caring at all.
Well, and maybe that's all it was. I mean, maybe that is part of it, is that he's just so, you know, completely out there that he just doesn't even notice that he's got it. But the thing was, he's transferring it from car to car. So I don't know if he had it. My guess is he had it in his pocket or in his wallet
or
and
something.
It fell out in the Moser's car. That would be my guess. Because otherwise, you know, it doesn't make any sense that he'd already been in a couple of other cars before he flagged them down. Mm-hmm. And then they picked him up. And then that's, of course, where the receipt was found, in this blood-stained, bullet-riddled car.
Yes. You described it very graphically.
You know, this story was always one that stuck with me, because here was this couple and their three kids from my hometown, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, Decatur, Illinois. I mean, how random is that? You know, they're on Route 66. They're heading out to Albuquerque to visit Carl's brother. And all they can do at this point, I mean, just nice people who just were trying to help out a kid, because
regular
that's what you
ass people.
In the 50s, you know, I mean, you thought it was OK to do this kind of stuff back then. People hitchhiked for years, and most people were fine hitchhiking. And the hitchhikers you picked up, the majority of them were fine. But this was kind of one of those things that started to turn that into something ugly.
I mean, my dad used to hitchhike from 367 and 270 to Montana all the time. And he said he said his dad would drop him off there and just let him go
hitch a ride. Yeah. And thing, you know, back then, you know, it was normal to hitch a ride, or, you know, normal to hitch a ride with truckers and stuff, you know. And then, of course, now we have, you know, over the road serial killers and people dying in rest stops. And, you know, I mean, and maybe it's because of the movies, or maybe the movies are caused by the events. And I think it's probably more the events created the films did this one.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. Having hard luck tattooed on your knuckles.
Man,
too.
I know.
That's rough.
It's either rough or it's really badass. But in this case, it's just, this guy is
badass if you don't hurt innocent people.
Right. There
children.
You go. I guess that's what I was thinking about it. You know, so it's like a hold fast, you know, sailor tattoo until you start killing people on the highway.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I don't mind a badass that has some morals and some lines.
Yeah, right. You know? There you go. So.
Gosh. Okay. And then kidnapping a deputy and then almost killing it. It's very like Fight
Club, again,
is what I think of.
It makes absolutely no sense. You know, he kills this entire family. Did he do it because their crying got on his nerves? I mean, is that all it was to it? I mean, because then he picks up this deputy and the cop is like, I am a dead man. I am dead for sure. And I mean, he drug him to the side of the road, put him in a ditch, cuffed his hands and told him he was going to kill him and then walked away. Why? I mean, maybe a car came along. I mean, it's hard. It's impossible to know. But yep. My guess would be probably that he just was a lunatic. You know,
I think it's the classic deranged. Thing. It's a yeah. classic thing of us trying to put ourselves into the mindset of
yeah.
a person who's not there.
Yeah, no way to do it. There's just no way to do it. You're right.
Yeah. And then the last words being, I hate everybody's guts and everybody hates
me. Yeah. Well, which I mean, you know, I mean, if you're going to go, if you're going to go out in the gas chamber, I mean, that's not a,
he's got not some, a bad he's one. Got some badass qualities.
Yeah.
He just didn't kill innocent
yeah,
people.
Yeah. If he could have just used him for something else, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's something that you write, into yeah. a pulp novel. You don't,
yes.
you don't choose it as your last words before you're, you know, gassed in San Quentin, you know,
yeah, yeah.
It's like Charlie Berger, when they went to hang him, the guy from Southern Illinois that says, you know, they blame me for a lot of things I didn't do, but they didn't catch a lot of the things that I did do. So we're about even.
That's
a cool quote. You know,
that's
a cool quote. That's the kind of quote you put on your gravestone. I hate everybody's guts and everybody hates mine is not one that you want to put on your gravestone.
No, so. It's not. It's not that cute. Yeah.
Not really.
But then, you know, kids killing animals around his grave and stuff, but then also, I mean, this is something that didn't help the Satanic Panic or Satanic
Satanic Panic,
which
Carlos
is a joke I've,
was
which
yeah
is, it is a yeah. joke I've made you about a bit I want to do sketch, but you know, killing some kid with a baseball bat and all that.
Oh, stuff, I know,
like, this didn't help.
No, it
any
didn't.
Of that
it, it really
stuff.
Didn't. And I mean, and it was at the height of it, and you know what they were doing. It's hard to say. You know, I guess they thought that they could maybe get in touch with this guy. They thought they were badasses too. And I got to be honest with you, Peace Church Cemetery is a creepy spot.
No shit.
It is. Yeah, it's outside. It's out in the outside of town, and it's last time I was there, it was pretty overgrown and pretty rough. But and nobody really knows where he's buried. Kids love to come out and try to mark where they think it is. And mm-hmm. that's what those kids were doing back in 87. They had come out there to, you know, and brought their unwitting pal with them and then beat him to death as a human sacrifice.
With a
trying to,
bat.
Yeah, trying to just, you know, I guess, contact the spirit of Billy Cook. It's which is, again, like, you know, when I always say people talk about, oh, well, you know, I could summon a demon. Why would you want to? And why
what
would
you
want to
do with Billy Cook?
Why would you want to ring up Billy Cook? You know,
bring up some dead loser like who?
But on the other
cares?
Hand, these kids were not exactly, you know, reputable citizens any either.
Well,
I mean,
sure.
they'd already killed animals out there and then brought their friend out there and killed him, too. So. You know, I don't know. The jury wasn't buying the satanic ritual stuff. I mean, they probably bought it, but knew that they weren't really going to contact Billy Cook. So they convicted him and off they went to prison. So, you know, they were a little too old to be, you know, got off on a juvenile technicality there. So but anyway,
right.
they say his ghost still haunts the graveyard. So yeah, that is what it is, you know,
and inspired.
It is one of those. Dude, it's a spooky spot. So I'm not surprised there are ghost stories. And the fact that he's buried there, it's a suitable place for him to be buried, I think.
Yeah.
Honestly. So
and it inspired the film. 1953 thriller, dude. That's
I mean, this thing came out a couple of months after he died. And it was definitely based on him. Ida Lupino was an actress. So her being a female director in 1953, she was pretty cutting edge.
Oh, wow.
She wrote this and she directed it. And, you know, the studios wouldn't let her, well, the Hays Code, the motion picture code, wouldn't let her use Billy Cook's name at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she had to change some of the things. And, you know, she couldn't have it exactly what had happened. So she had to kind of lean in and make it more about like sort of the last guys, the ones he picked up, you know, and took across the border with him. It turned out to be mostly those guys instead. So, I mean, she had to make some changes. But even so, I mean, she admitted this is where she got the idea and then went to San Quentin and interviewed him shortly before his execution. So that was... yeah, he definitely must have been as scary as because she's pretty tough. And she said, you know, her quote was, you know, I was afraid of him and couldn't wait to get the hell out of San Quentin, you know, after meeting this guy. So but the movie isn't, the movie's not bad. It's a very film noir kind of thing. I didn't put it on a watch list for you because I knew it was pretty hard to find.
It was hard to find. You knew that was all over the place anyway, but yes, but it did get my attention though. I'll tell you that.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting movie. And like I said, the guy that plays the Billy Cook character, I knew him just because I used to love to watch the old Perry Mason TV show. So he was always the prosecutor who lost every week to Perry Mason, of course. And it was funny to see him as this psycho, you know, because that's definitely not the character he played in Perry Mason. He was a prosecutor. So that was kind of cool. But what a tagline, though. You know, when we do our movie episodes, we're always looking for the taglines, and half the time they're really stupid. This is like the best tagline, one of the best ones I've ever seen, as a matter of fact. I love this. When was the last time you invited death into your car? I mean, it's a great tagline.
Dude, I'm throwing up the
I know.
It's metal. It's metal, I know. Dude. Like
it is so good. So
I love it. Can you tell me more just about, because you've done stuff about music and things. Can you just tell me more about Riders in the Storm and how that all
I actually your mind? Yeah, I did this story in my last Murder Ballads book that I did about music and talked about the Doors and their making of this album and stuff. So I got into it a lot more in the book, obviously, but this was their last album that they recorded as a band. And Riders on the Storm turned out to be the very last song that Jim Morrison ever recorded.
Really?
He recorded Riders on the Storm and then he left for Paris. And nobody knew if he didn't know if he was going to come back or not. You know, he really kind of had burned out on the whole band thing by then, and really just wanted to be thought of as a poet at that point. And I mean, he has tons and tons of really pretentious poetry out there that he wrote over time. So, yeah, I go back and forth with him. I think as a Doors fan, I always liked Jim Morrison as far as, you know, I thought he was really, you know, came up with some great stuff. And, you know, I thought he was a great performer and things. I mean, was he a pretentious prick? Absolutely. Would I have found him insufferable in real life? Probably.
Absolutely.
But on the other hand, as, you know, the member of the 20, I'm not going to get into all my conspiracy theories about Jim Morrison being alive. I'll save though. You can read those in one of my books.
Yes.
But whatever you believe in what happened to him, he never came back to LA, at least that we know of, after he recorded this. But this album, when they put this together, these guys were burned out, tired. You know, it was, everything was a mess. Nobody, you know, half the time they didn't show up, or Jim wouldn't show up, and then the other guys wouldn't show up. Everybody be high or they'd be drunk, and they couldn't get anything together because they were sick of each other and they were sick of, you know, recording music at this point. Yeah. But then, and their producer, you know, Rothschild was kind of a jerk anyway. And, you know, he ragged on him and ragged on him, ragged, so they couldn't get it together. And then he called Riders on the Storm bad cocktail music, which I mean,
it kind of is
cocktail music. It is,
I like it, but it is,
but there's a lot of weird stuff in that. You got, if you really listen to it, there is a lot of really eerie stuff in there. But anyway, when he walked out, suddenly everything came together and they got the album put together, and it came out in 71. And then Lover Madly was the first song, but the radio stations, because FM radio was, again, we're going to end up on a tangent here of like our VCR discussion.
We can do a bonus episode
talking about FM radio and stuff. They, you know, it was just really starting to take off in the early 70s, and FM radio in those days was where the underground stations were and where the album oriented stations were, the AOR stations, they call them. And they would play like, you know, that was the place where somebody decides they're going to play the entire side of, you know, Led Zeppelin IV, you know, just because they wanted to. And so it was that kind of thing. And Riders on the Storm, because it's like 7.5 minutes long, was really big on album stuff. It's kind of like when Light My Fire came out, you know, that song's like 11 minutes long.
I did not know that.
They had to do a radio cut, which is only, you know, like 3.5-4 minutes. And so that's what they played on AM radio and what they played on, you know, Ed Sullivan and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, the song really became a big hit, and LA Woman, the title cut and the album itself, is a great album. I mean, if you like The Doors. If you hate The Doors, then don't listen to it.
But
don't send me your messages to tell me you hate The Doors. I get it. It's not for everybody.
Yeah, and so
don't worry about it. I mean, because I like them and you don't, that's okay. We don't have to like the same music. It made it an interesting song just because, you know, Jim had seen the album, the movie. He knew the story behind it. And so, he, you know, some of the lyrics really are taken right from, you know, Billy Cook. I mean, there's no question about it. But I think, but for us, for what we're doing here, I think that Billy Cook's story inspiring The Hitcher,
yes,
is something that is a lot closer to home. Although John Ryder is no Billy Cook. He's much more evil. And I guess, okay, wait a minute. Maybe not much more
take it back.
Evil. Here's the difference. Uh-huh. Here's the difference. Billy Cook is stupid evil.
Yes.
The John Ryder character is just evil. I mean,
which one's more dangerous?
Manipulation. I know. Well, they're both unpredictable, just in different ways, you know? Yes. But I mean, I think that the way that Rutger Hauer plays John Ryder is he plays it just pure evil. I mean, just, yes. You know, oh, God, that movie is so good. That movie can still mess you up even after all these years, even if you've seen it before and watched it again, which I recommend people do. I just rewatched both of them not that long ago. And I'll say the same thing I said in the narrative here about the remake. It just, there's no point to it. And it's just, it's a different film and it's really just not, it's like the stakes aren't so as high as are in the original, you know, and the sequel is completely forgettable, but the original stands alone as a really great film and terrifying film. So. And not terrifying in a supernatural kind of way, terrifying in a this could really happen kind
of
way.
Yes, that's the thing. It's like how many ghosts do you know that have killed people? You know, how many people do you know
exactly
that have killed people?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the scary part. Gosh, it's been, we went through almost the most of the episode before getting to the actual movie that we're trying to talk about. But I know I would also recommend people if you've already seen it, give it a rewatch. I would say that for kind of most of the movies that we've talked about this season, but especially this one. If you've seen it before, give it a rewatch and check it
definitely.
Out.
Definitely.
Because I think this might make you see it in a different light if you don't know.
I think
know
so too, because I was impressed at the way this movie came together. I mean, you know, I didn't know really until I started doing the research. I mean, I knew it was based on a true story. I knew it was based on Billy Cook, you know, but I didn't know the whole Eric Red story of, you know, him driving cross country and getting this idea for a film. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and along comes this, you know, Billy Cook stuff when he's living in Texas. And, you know, the letter that he wrote is, you know, you got like, how big are this guy's balls?
Yeah.
I mean, he's just this, he's a guy who made one short film and he's convinced that he's got something. And he did, obviously he did, because man, they turned this thing around fast. But that quote that is in his letter about it grabs you by the guts and does not let up and does not let mm-hmm. go. When you read it, you will not sleep for a week. When the movie is made, the country will not sleep for a week. And it's like, dude, you know, he knew exactly how to trigger these, you know, movie execs. You know?
I hate when overly confident people are correctly
are right.
Yes, are correctly overly confident. Yeah. But hey, you know what? Credit where credit's due, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, I give him credit for that. And he's done a lot of other stuff since then. So he obviously knew what he was doing. But I really think that the John Ryder character is an unappreciated villain in horror film history. I really do. He doesn't get enough credit.
He's not brought up in any conversation.
Scary he is. No, you don't. No. People talk about Freddy Krueger. I mean, okay, sure. I guess he's. I mean, it would be scary if you were experiencing it. But Jesus, after like 8 movies, it's not scary anymore.
He just makes puns. He just makes puns, which I love a good
John
pun,
Ryder. But. John Ryder does not do puns. You know,
right?
It's just, and I know that you know it's a one movie thing, and maybe he needed to be around for a whole entire franchise to get named more often, but people forget about how scary this character is. So, like Billy Cook, for that matter. So, he's an unappreciated, or not appreciated, but maybe not as well known of a manic killer that he was. Everybody knows about Starkweather. How many people talk about Billy Cook?
Yeah,
see what I mean,
yeah. Not 100%,
just as scary. Yeah, but
well, gosh, I know we could go on and on about this, but I think I'm pretty good here. Is there anything else we missed?
Yeah,
to talk.
Yeah,
about?
No, I don't think so. I think we're good.
Okay. No. Well, hey, I don't have any Ghost Rider stuff, but if you have a question or comment about the world of the macabre, you can email me at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com.
Well, you couldn't find it right now anyway. in the middle of moving,
yes.
Even if you had it. So,
but I do know you have some.
I do
some hauntline stuff.
Yes, yes. So, did you say your email address, AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com, or did I just interrupt you?
No, both.
Both.
So, yes.
Okay.
AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah. So you can text us on the hauntline at 217-791-7859, and it might get read on the show. I do have a couple of people who mentioned, I wanted to talk about a couple of the guilty pleasures before I get into some stuff that were coming from like our last films. I have Angela in the 618 says, I can't believe no one brought up Ghost Ship. That's one of her go-to movies because the opening scene is so incredible. And I agree with that.
We had it on our list though, didn't
we? It wasn't on our, it wasn't on our guilty pleasures.
I thought it was in our email
chat
before. Though.
Maybe it was.
I thought it was in our email chat for that episode actually, but I think
it might've been, and it didn't for whatever reason wasn't on the list. But yeah, I agree with you that,
that opening scene.
Yeah. It's the opening scene is fantastic. And
it makes
so
the whole movie.
Yeah, it really does. It really does. I have Cindy from the 847. So Northern Illinois. She says, listening to this week's postmortem. Oh, I think this is about last week, but it's okay. It's been such a great skip down memory lane. I remember keeping a handwritten list of movies we wanted to rent, then having to search for the tags and then the boxes, talking about the rentals. And of course, the disappointment when your first option and most likely options 2 and 3 were already gone. She said, and then speaking of watching the tapes too many times, because I did mention that when we were talking about how they wore out. She said, I can admit that 2 movies over the years that had spots that I had rewound and rewatched so many times. And then she puts in quotation marks parentheses, like The Final Dance of Dirty Dancing, and they refused to play properly. So that's pretty funny. But let's see. I know there is one more here. Oh, it's from the 309, and it says, hey, Troy, it's Holly. This is one of our regulars, and she said, I wanted to share my guilty pleasure horror film with you. The 2023 Swedish film, The Conference. She says, about a group of corporate managers forced into a weekend retreat in a remote area where a killer begins to stalk and slash. She said, hey, I enjoyed it because I'm a director of professional development at my agency. So it gave me some tips for my next retreat planning. And then she said, just kidding. Maybe.
Wow. I love it.
Yeah. So Let's see. Oh, here's another one. This is Terry from the 509 Washington State. So a fan since the beginning, left a few remarks here as well, but keep up the excellent work. But I got to say, her guilty pleasures, all Kurt Russell movies. Love them. And for the most part, me too, because you mentioned or somebody mentioned Big Trouble in Little China, how much they liked it. And I'm like, of course you do, because it's amazing. Number two, guilty pleasure movies would be the full series of Tremors. And she says, yes, all seven of them.
Oh, now, wow.
I have not seen all seven. I've seen two,
few,
but yeah. Yeah. And so the other is the Creatures from the Black Lagoon movies. Because there are several of those, and it says prime effects for the time. She says, I love monster movies and just enjoy the Tremors movies for all the laughs and the humor.
Kevin Bacon.
Some Kevin Bacon. That's right. Let's see.
It's probably only one and maybe two, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, probably so. Cause I don't know how many are in all of them or who all is in all of them, but, anyway, here's another one. This one comes to us from the 724, and it says, which is Pennsylvania, that one I know. It says, remember having to rent the VCR too? Well, we were talking about renting the movies, and you used to have to rent the VCRs in the very beginning because not everyone could afford them. They were too expensive.
Yeah.
Because that stuff would come out, and they'd be like $700, $800 in, you know, 1980s dollars, and that was a lot. But it came in a big suitcase, and then you would have it for the weekend. I do remember that too. Pretty cool stuff. So, and then this one comes to us from Eric Vogel. He's in the 309, and he says, "Hey Troy, listen to the VHS talk. Boy, did that bring back memories. I remember we got a VHS player where you could set it up to record at a certain time and you didn't have to be home to push the red button. I mean, I remember when that was a big deal because before that it was, you know,
that was a thing I could do.
There was no way to record anything. You had to watch everything live.
I learned I could record like a cartoon that was on right before I got home from school. So I remember that part, but barely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He says, then Cody asking about Robert Barons brought back my days in college. I wrote a 20-page paper on Jay Gould versus the Erie Railroad during my Gilded Age class. I got an 89 because I started it the night before and got to 15 pages before I fell asleep and slept past the class. Got knocked a grade off for being a day late.
Hey, so, you know what? That's still pretty impressive, though.
Yeah,
you know?
It is. It is. I agree. Let's see. And then, hey guys, Bryce here again. This is Bryce. He's a recent Patreon supporter, our favorite hauntliner from Tucson. Oh, so that's where from the 480. I've decided I'm your favorite, at least from Tucson. That's what he says. Anyway, just heard your preview for American Nightmares, and holy shit, I cannot wait for that to hit the airwaves. Well, it has since this text came in. But Haunting Origins of America are a cool and underappreciated era of history. I trust you'll do it justice. Well, I will do my best.
That's awesome.
And then, yep, one more. I have one left, and it says, I love The Changeling, one of the most underrated movies. Still hate old-fashioned wheelchairs thanks to that movie.
That's fair. That's beautiful.
Also fair. I'm not surprised. So anyway, that is the haunt line for this time. So drop us a text if you would like to leave a comment or ask a question. And if we don't get it read on the air, I try to respond to them. I'm not super timely, but I will get a response to you. And the number on that is 217-791-7859.
Awesome, dude. Right. Hey. I'm ready to rock and roll.
Well, let's wrap this thing out. All right. Thanks again for checking out the story and the postmortem for this week's episode. We hope you love the show. And if you do, we hope you'll share it with your friends, family, strangers, and people you meet on the street. Encourage them to listen. And if you get a chance, we hope you'll leave us a review. Wherever you listen, it makes it easier for people to find us. Also, don't forget that as an American Haunties listener, you can use the discount code podcast for 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store. Because American Hauntings is more than just this podcast and now the other three that we do. It's also books, tours, ghost hunts, events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. You can find everything about us on the website at AmericanHauntings.net.
Beautiful. This episode of the American Hauntings Podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor. It was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show, check out the show notes or go to our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you can reach us via email, by text on the Haunt Line, or at Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Thanks again for listening. We couldn't and definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
And we'll see you later. See, I didn't interrupt you this time because, well, you have
I got enough shit going on. Yeah, I look like Mother Mary over here.
I'm just going to let this go this time so he can wrap this thing up and get it posted.